Hello, and welcome to the Outfield Flat Rule Podcast. My name is Brent Blackwell, here with Chris Jervis.
Good afternoon.
We wake on May 24th, and the Braves are in first place. May 24th, the Braves are in first place. How about that?
It's been a long time since we could say that.
Yeah, it's fun. It's, you know, you kind of keep just waiting for it to end, but you're already, I think the season is already a success, you know, like just 2 months of competitive baseball. We haven't had that in a long time. So
as long as we don't have a full on Freddie collapse, then I think this is going to be a positive season. Even if, you know, they do fade down the stretch, you have to look at this season and go, okay, we made steps and here we are. We still have plenty of baseball left to play.
Do you have a, win projection for this team? Like, combined, like what you've seen so far with what your expectations were, what would you predict wins?
I think my expectations coming into the season were probably 78 to 81. Maybe, you know, if things went the right way, we could get up to 83-ish. After watching them play, seeing the players develop, seeing how some things are going, you know, I'm probably closer to 83 to 85. And if things keep going the way they're going, maybe get closer up to that 88 to 90 range. I'm still not yet convinced. I think there's enough question at individual points to, you know, name them a slam dunk playoff team with 96 wins or something like that. But that's what they're playing right now. They're playing on a 97, 98 win pace. But I do think some of that is going to kind of come down a little bit, especially as we get into the hot summer where some of these pitchers might see some struggles either due to, you know, just overuse, or not overuse, but just wearing down, but also the ball carrying better during the summer. So we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. My gut would probably be somewhere around 86, 87 wins right now, just because we have such a head start. Like, even if we have a slump month or something, we're 10 games up over 500 right now, which is,
I was just thinking, I haven't done the numbers yet, but even if we just played 500 ball for the rest of the year, I think we end up around 83 wins, something like that.
If we play 500 ball the rest of the year, then that we'd still be 10 wins up. So it'd be 86 and 76.
There we go. See? Yeah. Power of math.
Anyway, so what did you think about the past week of Braves baseball?
I have not seen a lot of the past week just because I have been busy attending every high school graduation in the state of Georgia, which is apparently, I don't know when this happened, but, you know, throwing a kid a few bucks is not enough. Now you have to, like, buy him an entire living room suit or something. I don't know what the deal is. But so I haven't seen a lot of games. I'll be catching up on them after the fact. Been getting to them in the innings and whatnot.
We'll do a blow-by-blow review real quick. Friday, May 18th. We lost to the Marlins 2-0. Saturday, beat the Marlins 8-1 behind the strong pitching of Sean Newcomb. Sunday is a game that we will remember for years. That was the comeback game, 10-9 win. And then we had a three-game set with the Phillies, which involved a 3-0 loss, a 3-1 win, and a 4-0 loss last night. So overall of the week, 3-3 since we last had an off day.
I told folks before the season started that the Phillies were going to be better than people thought. There was a few people that I talked to regularly on groups and on Facebook, and Twitter, that said that they thought, you know, the Phillies were easy wins. And Odubel Herrera, I hate that guy. I hate him, hate him, hate him. He reminds me of Craig Counsell when he played for whoever he played with whenever we faced him. That guy always killed us. And Herrera is that same way. It seems like every time I turn around, he's doing something.
It's that batting stance, probably. It's that crazy batting stance that he has.
And he messes up pitchers' rhythms, too, with the stepping in and stepping out and taking forever to get in and forever, you know, late time and this and that and the other. I'm not one to call for the unwritten rules because I think they're stupid. But, you know, if you had to send a message pitch to somebody.
Oh, yeah, just something to shave the frosted tips off his braids. Like that kind of message.
Calling back shades of Yunel Escobar back in the day.
So recently I had the quote unquote pleasure of attending a Phillies game at Citizens Bank Park with, they were playing the Giants this a couple weeks ago. And from my seats, which were, you know, first row of the lower deck, along the first base line, I could I had a great view of the field, but a great view of the batter's box in particular. And looking at Herrera, there's just no way that guy can hit a baseball from the way he stands. That's what it looks like. It's the most funky batting stance, one of the funkiest ones in baseball today. And I can definitely understand why he reminds you of Craig Counsell, because it's, I feel like there's a level, it's like an added level of irritation when that guy gets a hit, because he looks like he should not, he looks like he's just picked up a baseball bat for the first time every time he steps in the batter's box.
He looks like he has one of those Japanese style baseball stances where they just, everything just kind of flows into something, and it's, you know, your personality is determined by your stance or something. Everybody has their own unique stance.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. But, so maybe there's like an efficiency to it. Maybe that's the proper batting stance. Who knows? But
I just get tired of seeing him up when we have runners on and we're trying to get out of an inning. And
yeah,
it's always him.
But back to your point, yeah, the Phillies have been good this year. They've been our biggest rival in the division. I don't know exactly. I think we're still at the point. I'm still at the point where I still expect Washington to be the team to beat this year. Like that, we're going to need to. As long as we're ahead of Washington, I feel pretty good about where we are. I don't know at what point that's going to change, though. Like, if that's still the case in mid-July, I don't know that I'm still going to be seeing Washington as that kind of team. But Washington is, I mean, they're only three games back. So they're not having as bad a season as I think people may think they're having.
Haven't they been injured a good bit this year?
Yeah, they've had some injuries. I'm blanking on who.
I try not to follow them any more than necessary.
The Mets are also – we're playing in a deep division this year. Now, granted, I wonder if we're all just if all these teams are just
– beating up on each other.
Or the Marlins. Yeah. They're beating up on the Marlins. The Marlins – I joked in the preseason that the Marlins were going to help every other team in the NL East get over 500 this year, and they've done that. Every other team is over 500. And I would say in the case of like maybe the Mets, it might be thanks to the Marlins. But yeah, so the Braves playoff odds right now are, remember when we started this like a few weeks ago, it was like 7%, right? And we were excited about 7%.
1.8% to win the division.
Yeah. Our playoff odds now, and this factors in preseason projections still. So this is with expected regression. Our playoff odds are 25.7%.
Woohoo! We're a quarter of the way there.
8.8 to win the division, 16.8 to win the wild card. We're getting into actual territory now where you start thinking about like, okay, how can Anthopoulos improve this team this year?
He took the first step by letting Joey Bats go.
That's true. That segues nicely into our transactions section. Yeah, Jose Bautista was released this week. It's the biggest transaction of the last week. Really the only one that I feel like we need to hit on. We got Dansby back from the DL. That was nice.
Gohara's back up in the big league. He threw a pretty nice game yesterday, I think. It was, what, four innings? He's going through some rough stuff personally, too. His father passed away. His mother's very ill. So wish the best for him. But, yeah, the Bautista experiment is over. I kind of understand what they were going for. It was a high, you know, there was virtually no risk to it. You know, it was a $1 million deal if he got called up and put on the 40-man roster. If he did something, great. If he didn't do anything, virtually no money lost whatsoever. You know, you're hoping you can catch lightning in a bottle with that power stroke that he has, but all he was doing was drawing walks, and then it got to the point where even he wasn't doing that enough. Sadly, putting him in wasn't much of a downgrade because Ryan Flaherty has been pretty bad himself. So, you know, he started off strong, but he's been pretty bad for a while now. Camargo has not been doing what he did last year. So third base has kind of been an empty spot for Atlanta all year, with the exception of the first 15 games of the season.
Yeah, I think with Flaherty, even in those first 2 weeks, we knew what was happening, which is like, awesome. We're getting the best 2 weeks of Ryan Flaherty's life. And it's great to be around when that happens. Like, I remember, I always think of that speedy outfielder, Jose Constanza, when we got the best two, three weeks of his life that one year. You know, it's not going to last, but at the same time, you're thankful for it because those first 2-3 weeks of Ryan Flaherty could very well be what puts us into a wild card game or a division title down the line. But the key is not expecting those 2 or 3 weeks to turn into a breakout career season when he's 31 and was freely available on opening day for any team to sign for a reason. So Camargo seems to be the third baseman for now.
I think that's probably a good move for the simple reason that he's a better defender. He's got a better arm. He's got some positional versatility too. So that would allow you to, if you wanted to do a double switch or something later in the game, you can move him around and play your matchups a little bit better if you wanted to drop Flaherty in at third or whatever. But I like having Camargo out there. He's a switch hitter. He helps break up some of the lefty-righty matchups. But I would like to see some production. I'm kind of gloating on the inside a little bit because I spent a lot of last year saying Camargo is not this player, but I also don't think he's a 214 guy that he's showing right now. He's walking a lot this year, so he's getting on base. He's not making outs. He's just not hitting a lot. But, you know, a batter's primary job is to not make outs, and right now he's doing that at a pretty decent rate. I think it was a 348 on base percentage for the season. So
it's up to 382.
His OBP?
Yeah.
Wow.
He has he's third on the team in walks after Freddie and Markakis.
Nice.
He has 18 walks in 89 plate appearances.
That's even better.
and a hit by pitch, which adds to it as well. So he's reached base 19 times this year without swinging the bat,
hits are better than walks, but walks are better than making outs. And if your only way of getting on base is to make an out, is to walk, then take advantage of it. I mean, that's not the only thing he's doing this year. We know, you know, Camargo showed last year that he can hit in Major League. But the idea is don't make an out. And right now he's not making outs.
Yeah, I think he's a guy whose numbers, if he continues to play the way he has this year, his numbers are gonna spike upward significantly. I think he's playing really well so far this year.
We mentioned before the show started that I had been looking at Camargo because he seemed to be a different batter this year in terms of some of the things he was doing, his approach and whatnot. And that's probably going to be the next thing that I write probably later on today or tomorrow, is comparing Camargo last year to this year. He, last year he was destroying left-handed pitching, just killing it. This year he can't hit left-handed pitching to save his life, and he's killing right-handed pitching. It's almost like he's become an opposite of what he was doing last year.
That's always interesting when a player like does something. I'll be interested to see if you find that he's doing anything differently or if it's just different results.
Well, that's what I was looking at with Markakis, and there was actually a change in approach with him. So we'll see. Sometimes you just get lost in doing the research. You go in looking for something, and then you get in there and look at it like, oh, that's not what I thought.
Right. But yeah, the Bautista experiment is over. I guess my question is, at what point, and do you think Camargo's batting average, I really hope it's not the batting average that decides it, but at what point does Camargo's batting average being 214, maybe even in a couple of weeks like 230, 240, at what point does that start to itch the GM's finger to call up Austin Riley after the June 3rd, June 4th Super 2 date?
I don't think the Super 2 date itself is going to be a deadline of any sorts. The Braves have not really been concerned in the past with Super 2 deadlines. We had Vizcaíno and Winkler were both Super 2s that the Braves could have manipulated service time so they didn't hit it. That didn't happen. They've had it in the past. Didn't happen. I think that the Super 2 deadline just is conveniently also happens to be, you know, around the same time that Riley has had 2 months in AAA. And you have enough data there to get an idea of what he is. If this time, a month from now, you know, Camargo's still not hitting well, Flaherty's still struggling, I think there might be some push to try and either fill that spot with, you know, a one-off guy who can finish out the year via trade or calling up Riley. If you call up Riley, you know, you, at that point, you have a lot of young players on the team that you're counting on to try and make a run. So the plus is you could have the core of your next playoff team all playing together at the same time and getting familiar with one another and gelling. The downside is you have a lot of 20-year-old guys on your playoff team. And, you know, so what do you, how far do you expect to get with that? There's been a lot of talk, you know, potentially of targeting a guy like a Moustakas for the remainder of the year or somebody like that. I don't know what the, you know, the trigger point is, but I think Anthopoulos has shown that he's not caught up on batting average. And if Camargo is still getting on base, I think he would be willing to, you know, let that ride for the year until he feels like Riley is ready for a call up. But at the same time, fans are excited. And if you can take advantage of filling that hole with somebody, whether it be Riley or, you know, some trade candidate, to maybe strengthen the team to get some production that you're not getting right now, because walks are good, but a hit moves the ball around, moves the runners around quicker and more bases. I was going to say, at some point, they may want to take advantage of the goodwill that's been built up with this season and try and take a little bit bigger step than just calling up the next young phenom.
Yeah. I like the idea, and I'm sure they do too. I'm sure this also adds to the temptation to call up Riley, is that I really like having Camargo as the utility guy on the bench, because he's a guy you feel comfortable giving a start at shortstop or second base to when Albies or Swanson, you know, needs a day off here or there. And in some sort of an emergency, Camargo is a guy you feel okay putting in an outfield probably. So
we also have the option of, you know, we haven't seen him yet, but we picked up Phil Gosselin not too long ago. You know, if it's just a matter of trying to fill the spot and keeping Riley down until you feel that he's comfortable and ready, you might see a call up of Phil Gosselin. I mean, he's not a guy who's going to, you feel comfortable going into the playoffs with as your starting third baseman. But if the goal is to get you further down the line until it's time to make a decision, you know, kick the can down the road until, so that you can look for other options, he's one we might see come up as well, especially with the way Culberson's been playing.
Yeah, Riley still has less than 400 at-bats or plate appearances in the high minors in AA and AAA combined for his career. He's batted 381 times in the high minors. And granted, he's destroyed pitching in the high minors everywhere he's been. But yeah, I'm with you. I think a little more seasoning wouldn't hurt, but I still would. It wouldn't surprise me to see him this year. I think we'll see him at some point if he keeps hitting like this. He's going to bring a lot of strikeouts probably with him, but if he can hit for power when he hits, then the strikeouts will be worth it. So I'm getting excited to see him, because I think the team will want to see him at some point this year also, just to have an idea of what they've got before this following free agency period with Donaldson and Machado. I don't think we're going to have the money to go after Machado, but at the same time, we might. And I think it's a good idea to have at least seen the guy who's, you know, OPSing 800 in AAA when you do that. 850. Jeez. Yeah.
Just as an exercise in futility, I put together a roster for next year that included both Craig Kimbrell and Bruce Hooper, just to mess with some Braves fans. I decided not to publish it anywhere because seeing Bryce Harper on the Braves may have caused a blowback that I was not prepared to handle. But I think if everything falls together right, the Braves are going to have the money to make a couple of big signings if they wanted to. Now, the Braves have never been big players in the free agent market. It's always cheaper to build from within than it is to buy. But, you know, we have some holes and there's some good players available. And there's so much talent available next year that they can't all be signed by the same five or six teams. So somebody's going to be stuck taking a deal either below market or below what they thought they could get because somebody else has already been signed.
Yeah, and also this is the time to make a move over the next few years to get a good player, another star player, because, you know, we've got Freddie Freeman for, what, three more seasons after this? We've got four or five years of Ozzie Albies, six more years of Ronald Acuna. So the window...
Got Ender Inciarte.
Yeah, the window is... The target should be win a World Series around 2020 or so. Or, you know, in that window that surrounds the 2020 season. So 2019, 2020, 2021. And... Yeah, I think this is the time when you do make that big signing if you can, because it's you're gonna be able to complement that with a lot of young affordable talent. Normally, a team that has players like that are as good as Acuna, Albies, etc., they're having to pay them like Newcomb. They're having to pay them a lot of money, but we have the luxury of having all these guys playing in their first 6 years. So
our window is the next 6 years, because otherwise we're going to get hammered with arbitration deals down the road. 2021 and 2022, it's a good thing that Freddie and some of those guys are coming off the books then, because we'll need that money to pay some of these guys.
Yeah, and I could see the team extending Freddie if he's – I think he'll age pretty well, and I think he'll be the kind of first baseman who is still a good hitter when he's 34, 35 years old. But – I think when you have players, when you have good players that are so cheap, you can more easily justify overpaying someone, because, yeah, it's, and I'm certainly not suggesting that we will pay Bryce Harper $30 million a year, but I'm just taking that as an example, because that's a lot of money for a player, $30 million. And you may look at Bryce Harper, $30 million in isolation, in a vacuum, and say, that's too much money. But then you could say, well, you can have Bryce Harper and Ozzie Albies for a total of $30.5 million a year. And you're like, oh, absolutely. That's a great deal. And so when you start looking at it like that, then it becomes
exactly
much more justifiable when you have all these really cheap players. So, yeah, I do. But I think in order for us to know our offseason plans at third base, we need to get a look at Austin Riley this year, especially if he's this close. And he seems to be very close. So I guess that closes the book on our third base talk for the time being. We had an interesting question from someone, and we decided to make it our topic of the day. Do you want to intro that, because you're the one who received the question?
Basically, we had a reader, listener, member of our Facebook group ask a question that was, and I don't have it right in front of me, but essentially he was asking, why is the offense so much better this year, especially if we have some of the same players? Is it because we have different players at different spots, or are the guys doing something differently? What's different about this year versus last year, when we were wondering, you know, the team was not supposed to have any power, and here we are, a team that is near the top of the league in power. What's different? So I started looking at it, and I said, you know, it's actually not a bad question. You know, is it the players only that are different? Is it the approach that's different? So I know you and I both kind of took a look at different aspects of it to see if we could come up with anything that's primarily a reason why the team is having a lot better success this year. And the one thing that kind of stood out to me above anything else was this team is walking more. I don't know if it's a conscious decision to take more walks, but they're not swinging at pitches out of the strike zone as much as they were last year. A lot of that can be attributed to, say, Matt Kemp or some other guys who aren't here now. Some of it can be attributed to just tightening up on mechanics and you know, picking your pitch. But one of the big things that this team is doing is they're not swinging, you know, they're swinging at fewer pitches outside of the strike zone. It's more walks. More walks mean more base runners. Once you put base runners on base, pitchers are significantly less effective when there are runners on base. So I think that just by itself is helping contribute to it. Then on top of that, when they are swinging, this is the thing that surprised me. They're swinging at fewer pitches outside of the strike zone, but they're actually making better contact on pitches outside of the strike zone. So they're getting more of the bat on the ball outside of pitches, on pitches outside of the strike zone. Overall contact rate is about the same as last year. They're not making any significant more contact this year than they were last year. They're seeing the same number of pitches in the zone this year as they had last year. So it's not like they're getting better pitches to hit. They're just, the big thing is the strikeout rate's the same as last year, almost exactly the same as last year. There are fewer swinging strikes this year, so they're taking more called strikes. But when they do swing the bat, they seem to be making contact more often than they were last year. You know, as far as the plate discipline approach, they're just not swinging at bad stuff like they were last year.
Yeah, so I was looking through a lot of the same things you were looking at, and I've got the hard numbers here, and this is number. They always say don't use stats on podcasts, but I also don't really listen to what they say, so I'm going to use them anyway. We have lowered our swing rate on, like you said, pitches that are outside the strike zone. We swung at over a third of those pitches last year. Now we're under 30%. So it's not huge changes. Well, it doesn't seem like huge changes, but that is actually a big change for an entire team.
That's a 10% difference.
It's a drop of 4.1 percentage points, which was, like you said, way over 10% change. We're swinging at more pitches inside the strike zone. Now that's very slight uptick, but those are both the directions you want to do. Baseball is a simple game as far as process goes. Swing at strikes, don't swing at balls. And, you know, the more you do of both of those things, the more success you're probably going to have at the plate. And the Braves have swung at slightly more strikes this year, and we're swinging at way fewer balls. The team is actually making worse contact in the zone, which tells me, but it's very slight change, but that might explain the power. We're swinging harder, you know, the more all or nothing swings you have, the more power you're going to produce, and the more strikes or, you know, swing and misses you're going to have. That kind of goes hand in hand with the power increase is what I'm saying. Overall, the overall contact rate is up, like you said, thanks to the making better contact on pitches outside the strike zone. So I think that's, as a team-wide thing, that's something I've noticed, is that we are better with plate discipline this year. Now, is that a function of having – is it individual player improvement among players who were here last year, or is it having better players at some positions?
I'm not real sure. I haven't looked at the individual players. I know some of them have had some changes from last year.
Okay, so yeah, we were going to do a position-by-position look at the Braves from 2017 to 2018 and see where the biggest differences are. Hopefully we can point to this as a, you know, an answer to that question. And I was looking by position, and these are just the position averages. So this factors, when we say 2017 second base, we mean Brandon Phillips and Ozzy Albies and anybody else who played second base during 2017. With that in mind, Chris, where would you guess the three biggest improvement positions have been?
From 17 over to 18?
Yeah.
Probably shortstop, second base, left field.
You got one of those correct.
You know what?
One of those.
Maybe right field.
Right field has seen the biggest increase of any position. Nick Markakis 2017 to Nick Markakis 2018 is the biggest change the Braves have had at any position from last year to this year. He went from being 5% worse than league average, a 95 WRC plus, to a 152.
Oh.
Yeah, it's nuts, and he's legitimately a better hitter. He's got 7 home runs, which seems like as many home runs as he's had in his Braves career coming into this season. That's probably wrong, but that's what it feels like at least. And he has been the most improved player. You were correct on the number two position where we've improved the most is second base. Ozzy Albies, the Brandon Phillips Ozzy Albies combo last year, is dwarfed by this new Ozzy Albies for this year, which is just still remarkable. Keeps hitting home runs every day. And they're all the same kind of home run, too. It's just, man, I don't think there's a hitter in baseball who has a better feel for just how to put a ball right over the fence, like a strongly pulled baseball, right over the fence than Ozzie Albies.
Leads the league in scrapers.
Yeah. But hey, they count just as much as those Giancarlo Stanton homers do. And then the third most improved position on the team is actually Freddie Freeman, who is hitting out of his mind. And I think he gets lost in the shuffle a little bit with excitement over the new guys or the people like Markakis who are doing things we haven't seen him be really good in Atlanta. But Freddie,
you and I have talked about Freeman in the past and how some Atlanta fans are spoiled on him. And if he's only got a 903 or a 964 OPS or something like that, they're talking about his slumping and him needing a day off and how he's just not himself. People, adjust your expectations. Watch a few baseball games outside of Atlanta. You're watching probably the premier hitter in the National League right now, if not the one of the top five easily. And you're complaining about him not doing enough. Stop it. Just stop.
I certainly agree with people who say that Ozzie Albies is the most exciting player on the team. Freddie Freeman is the best player on the team, though. And I don't think it's close. He is, at least offensively goes. And now maybe you can make a case for somebody's defense, giving them more value. But Freddie Freeman is maybe the best hitter in the league. He is, his on base is at 424, which is ridiculous. We thought last year was ridiculous when he got into that chipper area of right. 300, 400, 500 on his slash stats. And now he is well above 300, 400, 500 on all three slash stats. And he's striking out only 15.7% of the time. This is a guy who struck out 2 years ago, 25% of the time. He is in 2 years, he has cut his strikeouts from 25% to 15%. And that is insane.
Yeah.
Especially for a guy who's like added power.
I looked at it a couple of days ago. I believe the number one, the hardest batter to strike out in the major leagues right now, or at least in the National League, is Nick Markakis. But I believe Freeman is in that top 10 of hardest batters to strike out, which if you followed his career is a complete turnaround because, and he never was a strikeout prone batter, but he was your typical power hitter who was selling out power in lieu of, you know, you would have to accept a 25% or 23% strikeout rate to get his homers. Now he's providing that same power with half the strikeout rate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 2 years ago, he struck out 171 times. And that was a year that everybody agreed was a huge breakout season for Freddie, where he became a dominant hitter. Everybody was fine with the strikeouts, but yeah, now he's just cut back on him, which is, like I said, it is astounding what he's been able to do this year. And he's increased his walk rate. His walk rate's the highest of his career. The strikeout rate's the lowest of his career. They've almost converged, which is, again, I think Albert Pujols in the early 2000s was the last time I saw a power hitter who could consistently like walk more than he struck out, other than, well, Barry Bonds or whatever. This is the age of the strikeout as well. Strikeouts across baseball are rising and Freddie's are dropping. So I think it's easy to say, well, you know, Dansby, not easy, but I think that's what my eyes jump to too. Like Dansby Swanson isn't sucking this year. Third base has gotten better this year. Left field has improved. But man, Freddie Freeman is just, he is right there leading the charge in improvement from 2017 to 2018.
I'll take it.
Two positions where we've actually had worse production offensively are catcher and center field, but our production is still pretty good at both. Center field's been our worst offensive position this year at just 89 WRC plus for Ender, but
he got off to a bad start. He's really been hitting well lately.
And he's turning it around. So that's good.
And for the years that he's been here, Inciarte has always started off slow. I believe the first two seasons he had hamstring injuries that slowed him to get to a start last year. And then the year before this year, he just got off to a bad start. But he always seems to, you know, when you look at it at the end of the season, you're going to see a, you know, 330 on base percentage, you know, 290-ish hitting, something like that, 280-ish. The power, you know, he's a lot like Juan Pierre. He gets on base, doesn't provide you a lot of power, but he does provide premier elite defense in center field. And he's stealing bases like crazy this year, although there's been a couple of decisions where he's decided to run that I kind of wished he didn't, but he's still been very successful on the base paths this year.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. He's in fact, he's a guy who, well, he is doing better lately, but as a guy who for the season as a whole hasn't been a huge offensive force, but is stealing a lot of bases, makes him that perfect, like, number six, number seven hitter for a lineup, because we've mentioned it on this podcast many times that I prefer steals at the bottom of the lineup when you don't have doubles and homers come in right behind them, when it's singles.
Right. I mean, it makes no sense for Ender Inciarte to be at the top of the order ahead of, you know, a Freddie Freeman who could bring him around with one swing versus hitting at sixth or seventh where he's got Swanson behind him or, you know, Ryan Flaherty or insert singles hitter here where you have to play station to station baseball. It's a lot easier for him to steal his way into scoring position lower in the order. And you're also not taking the bat. You're not forcing the batter to protect your steal attempt by swinging at something that maybe he doesn't want to swing at.
Right. Yeah. So, there's just a lot to like about this offense this year, it seems.
It's one of those lineups. There's not been a consistent lineup where everything is exactly the same. There's been some tweaking here and moving this guy there and putting this guy here. And no matter where people hit or no matter where people are slotted in, they still seem to be just going out there and doing their thing. And that's the way it should be in the bullpen too. But that's another story.
I also looked at the offense from our pitchers this year has also improved.
Just get a bump down. That's all I'm asking.
They have gone from a negative 44 WRC plus to a negative 29. So that's improvement right there. The pitchers have improved as much as like left field has. Right.
Well, I mean, in addition to the plate discipline issues with swinging fewer pitches outside of the strike zone, taking more walks, things like that. You know, we're also seeing things that have a direct correlation to better hitting. We have a higher line drive rate overall as a team this year. We have significantly fewer ground balls as a team this year, about 10% less overall. We're hitting more fly balls. Our home run per fly ball ratio is up. You know, the fly balls that we are hitting, more are going for home runs. And in something, this may cause Joe Simpson's head to explode. But we're actually pulling more balls this year. We're sending fewer balls to center field and to opposite field. We're actually pulling more as a team this year. And I know that's going to cause some consternation among some people, but, you know, power hitters like to pull the ball because it's a shorter flight. It's a, you know, easier way to get the ball over the fence. But we're also hitting the ball harder this year. Last year, I think it was 81% of the balls were considered hard hit or medium hit. This year, we're close to 84%. That doesn't sound like a lot, but it's these incremental increases in several different areas that are all coming together in one big soup of goodness for the offense. And, you know, I hope they can continue it. Some guys are going to fall off and not keep doing what they're doing. Some guys are going to keep doing what they're doing. Some guys are going to come back and improve over what they've done so far. But by and large, players tend to, you know, barring some changes in mechanics or approach, players tend to end up the season near what their talent level is. In the case of Ryan Flaherty, I think what we're seeing with him now is probably indicative of what his career is, which is why a lot of people are saying, okay, we're not getting anything from third base. If Camargo can't do anything, let's maybe step outside the team and see what we can do. But even with, you know, I won't even call third base a black hole this year, but even with the lack of production after the first month of the season at third base, this has been a fun offense to watch.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's even the positions that are slightly below league average offensively, which are besides center, it's third, short, and left field have all been, but they're all in the 90s in WRC plus. So they're like, they're pretty close to league average. And honestly, at shortstop, a league average hitter is way better than an average shortstop. So Dansby is good at shortstop.
Especially with the defense he's putting up. Dansby's, people haven't talked about it, but his defense has really significantly increased this year. I just saw something before we went on the air that Swanson has the, I think it was one more or the same number of defensive runs saved as Andrelton Simmons this year. And he's done it in 160 fewer innings in the field. Dansby's defense has significantly improved this year. And you were talking about left field being slightly less productive than last year. Last year, you know, we had a former MVP manning left field. This year, we've got a 20-year-old rookie and a scrap heap pickup manning left field. So, I mean, Acuna, he's going to have his adjustments. He's going to, you know, it's pitchers are not throwing him the fastballs down the middle. Like maybe, you know, when an acclaimed rookie comes up, a lot of times a pitcher takes it as a challenge. Okay, kid, let's see what you got, and just feeds him fastballs until he shows he can hit them. Well, he's shown he can hit those. Now they're starting to adjust. He needs to adjust. I think that'll happen. I think there are certain areas where we're going to see some improvement, some areas where we may see some regression. But all in all, this offense has shown more power than I expected. It's shown more plate discipline than I expected. And it's put up far more runs than I expected. And I'll be glad to be wrong on this.
Yeah, happily. I wanted to just give a little bit of context to people for what exactly we're talking about when we're talking about Ryan Flaherty, because you glance at Ryan Flaherty's numbers and they're still pretty good. He's batting 275. He's got an on base of 368, and that's for the season. But I went to his game logs on Baseball Reference, and on April 20th, he went 2-for-4 with a double against the Mets. It was a extra inning loss to the Mets. We lost that game 5-3. He did his part though that day. 2-for-4, had a good day. Since that game, Flaherty is batting 176. He has a 250 on base and a 235 slugging percentage. So, and that last month, the last month we've seen from him is more like what Ryan Flaherty has done for his career. So, I think I want to just illustrate what we mean when we say Ryan Flaherty is you know, kind of coming back to earth. He's playing like Ryan Flaherty again.
Right. I tweeted this last night going into while the game was on last night, that Ryan Flaherty in his first 15 games of the season, he had 60 plate appearances. He hit 365, 450, 500 for a 950 OPS in the first 60 plate appearances he's had. In the last 60 plate appearances, now this was before last night's game. This was going into last night's game. His last 60 plate appearances, so same amount of playing time, 192, 300, 269. So he's got a 569 OPS then. And it actually went down after an 0-for-4 last night. After his first two, after his 0-for-2 last night and first two plate appearances, it had dropped down to 185, 290, 259. That's a big way of saying, hey, we got the best out of Ryan Flaherty we could, but this is kind of who he is. He's not a 192 career hitter. You know, he's not that guy. So he is getting a little bit of probably bad luck in some regard. But at the same time, you know, his career average was, what, 221, 222? He's not going to give you 365 for the rest of the year. And he's, you know, as guys play more, their talent level, their numbers tend to float more towards their talent level. Sometimes it's going up, like in the case of Freddie Freeman when he had that really bad start 2 years ago. People forget, in that breakout year that he had, he started off hideously awful in the first 3 or 4 weeks of the season, to the point we had people calling him overpaid and calling for him to be traded and talking about how him not being that good and this and that and the other. And then he turns into freaking Mike Trout, a first baseman for about 2 years, 2.5 years. Players tend to navigate, you know, their numbers tend to migrate towards their talent levels, you know, especially if there's no changes in anything. And in this case, Flaherty wasn't really changing anything in his approach that I was able to see. He was just getting the benefit of some good. And sometimes you just get, you know, hot streaks. Guys just get hot and they pile everything up. You know, in his case, he did it all in the first 2 weeks of the season. And that's not to knock him. I mean, he serves a role. He could be, you know, the guy has made a major league career of being a bench player for, what, 6 or 7 years. So he does bring value, but he shouldn't be the starting third baseman on what potentially is a playoff team.
Right. Yeah, I have no problem with him being on the bench. But yeah, I agree. He should not be a starter for a team that is serious about its aspirations, which the Braves at this point are. Yeah. All right. Well, the week ahead, where do you,
I still have more graduations to go to, so I'm probably going to miss more games.
Oh man. This weekend looks like a fun series. We are headed to Boston. shipping up to Boston for a series with the Red Sox.
You hear that, Wachowicz? We're coming for you.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Wesco will that'll be fun. We rarely get to
you know, he's just going to bring up 28-3, you know, so we should probably just let this dog lie.
Probably.
So yeah, we have
any Gator fan too, yeah, though. Well,
he's a good guy, but he has his faults. So just for the just for those involved, we have a mutual friend, a good friend of mine who is from Boston. So he likes to remind us of these things. But yeah, I'm going to miss some of the games this week just because I'll be going to graduations again and whatnot. But it's a good thing we're on the road because I'm looking at the weather and it's supposed to rain for like 17 days straight in Atlanta. So this is getting ridiculous. My lawn, I'm sinking into the lawn as I walk out onto the front yard.
I'm really excited about this weekend series because while the Phillies are good and while the Cubs are good, this Boston team just feels different. And it's really nice for this Atlanta team to be able to test themselves against what is clearly a buzzsaw of a major league team right now, the Red Sox.
And we get to see our old buddy Craig Kimbrel again.
Hopefully not.
Yeah, that's true.
I hope he sits on his ass for 3 days and has nothing to do.
You know what? I hope Freddie is calling for him out in the or not calling for him out in the bullpen as we have the lead.
So. After that, we get a home set. The Braves come back home on Monday, and we've got a doubleheader with the New York Mets.
So two right-outs. Nice.
And then we got the Mets again on Tuesday, then on Wednesday, and then we go straight into a four-game series, a home set with the Nationals. So, you know, a lot of games against top NL East competition right now. When do we play the Marlins again? That's what I want to see. Oh, Lord, it's late July. So this is going to be a key couple of weeks for the Braves.
No, just
here.
Keep going out and winning two out of three, you know, two out of four, and we'll stay ahead of the game. You know, even late, we mentioned it before, even if we go 500 the rest of the season, we're still going to end up at, what, 86 wins? That's probably just on the outside cusp of the wild card, number two wild card. You know, we play slightly over 500 mm-hmm. the rest of the way. You know, all of a sudden we're potentially in division winning range or, you know, first wild card. We're not having to chase so much as be chased. So, I mean, there's a lot of baseball still to be played and a lot can happen, but I like where we are. This team's further along than what I thought. You know, I really thought when this rebuild started a couple of years ago, I know the team said, hey, 2017, publicly they said 2017, we aim to compete, but I thought that was pretty. I thought 18 or 19 was more accurate just based on how these things happen. But the team kind of sort of had to say 2017 because they were opening a new ballpark and they had to encourage people to come to a new ballpark and spend money. But I think 2018 was always the more accurate timeline of gauging where you were, with 2019 being really the, okay, we're ready to make our run. This is our chance type of season. And right now, you know, Anthopoulos has them right on target for that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think also originally the 2017 outlook was, it was very optimistic, but it was possible if certain players kind of hit, like if Foltynewicz and Sean Newcomb both were immediate aces. And if Rio Ruiz was the answer at third base, you know, so
if Aaron Blair turned into a major league ready pitcher, if Matt Wisler could give them some functional innings.
Right. Right. So it was a lot of that. And it was that first wave was either slow to develop or non-developing. And so that's why 2017 really didn't happen. And that's why I think a lot of people weren't necessarily expecting 2018 to click the way it has, because it is unlikely for you to hit on, you know, all these prospects the way the Braves have started to hit. Right. So
you know, people talk about, you know, Frank Wren got a bad rap when he was rushed out of here. And a lot of this was put into place, you know, by Wren. John Coppolella, banned from baseball. But a lot of this was put in place by Coppolella. Anthopoulos has filled in some holes here mm-hmm. and there. It's all kind of come together. And everybody's had a hand in it in one way or another. And I think it was John Coppolella who said, you know, what he wanted to build was not just a one-time winner, but waves of talent crashing on the shore. And I think we're seeing that now. We're starting to see some of these guys. I mean, we still have good talent down in the minors that hasn't come up yet. Austin Riley's still down in the minors. We still have, you know, Colby Allard waiting down in the wings. I mean, we've got help down there that, to, you know, exactly. Kyle Moeller's been doing well. We still have some good, you know, some good relief prospects down there. So, you know, I like where we're positioned.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. It's I think all those GMs had their strengths. So maybe this is a different podcast for a different time, but yeah, it's I still don't know. We still don't really know what Anthopoulos's vision for this team is. But so far he seems to be doing the right thing in that he's not Dave Dombrowski. So he's not like immediately trading all our prospects for all stars from 2014 or something. So far he's passing the test, but it's this offseason will be an interesting one for sure. Okay. All right. Well, that was the Outfield Fly Rule podcast. What number was this? Oh for three?
Oh for three. We are now 0 for 3.
0 for 3. All right. We'd love for you to subscribe out there. God, it's been a while since I'm still not used to doing these outros.
You can see us on Facebook at Outfield Fly Rule Facebook group. We also have a Facebook page for Outfield Fly Rule. The group's more active, more day-to-day conversation. The page is more for transactions and news. We also are on the Twitters at OFR Sports, at OFR Sports. You can check out the website at outfieldflyrule.com, where you will see, if you have your ad blocker turned off, an ad for our book that we wrote. It previewed the 2018 season. Even though the 2018 season is well underway in the major league level, there are still some minor league teams that have just gotten underway, and you can get some good information on some of those minor league prospects. We wrote about every player in the Braves system, from the lowest minor league guy all the way up to Freddie Freeman. Go check it out. It can be found at an Amazon near you, the 2018 Outfield Fly or 2018 season preview. We also did that with Walk Off Walk, the guys over at Walk Off Walk. So check it out.
And I think that'll do it. So that's all for us. Enjoy your off day and go Braves.
Go Braves. Talk about the line in Massachusetts. Speak about the people I have seen. See.